This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outward and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
So one of the difficulties we have in life is sometimes turbulence comes our way. Sometimes people die, we lose our houses or our cars or our pets, or some disaster comes to us, and then we're not prepared for that. We're not prepared for change. We've enjoyed those things, but then when they disappear or they vanish, it causes us to suffer. And so when we talk about meditation in Buddhism, we're talking about mindfulness, learning to be mindful throughout the day. And that mindfulness gives us like peace in our heart. And then because we have peace, that enables us to contemplate life. And then when we contemplate life, we see that when we were born, we didn't come with anything. And when we die, we don't go with anything. But what we do have is we have our actions as our support. So even though we think we're very clever with all these inventions and microwaves and everything else, and we've got all these fancy gyms and we've got good sewerage and nice roads, but where's the science of the heart? Where's the learning to be good people? And so that's why when things go wrong in our lives, even though we have all these external comforts, we don't have comfort in the heart. Because we haven't prepared our minds for change. We haven't prepared our hearts to be able to see things as they really are. And the Buddha called it samudaya, like conventional reality. You know, this is the source of our suffering, that we have all these stories in our minds of how things are, but it's not actually how things are. You know, we look in the mirror each day and we go, yeah, that's me. But actually, each in-breath and out-breath we take, every time we eat more food, every time our bodies are changing. I think even science says in 7 years, almost every cell in your body has completely changed. Yet we look in the mirror and we go, I'm the same person that I was 20, 30 years ago. and actually, even more than that, you look at the mind. Some days we're angry. Some days we're happy. Some days we're joyful. Some days we're grieving. Now, which one is us? And the same with other people. So in Buddhism, rather than worrying too much about other people, we're taught to look after our own minds. That the enlightened beings, the beings of practice, they can only point the way, that we have to do the work ourselves. And there's no point going around pointing out all the faults of others when we haven't purified our own hearts. And so the practice is, first of all, learning what is a good person. You know, so that's our actions of body, our actions of speech, and then eventually, once we purify them, you get strength of mind because you're able to learn to have discipline to control those areas, and then even the mind itself. We have this covetedness and grief, liking and disliking, it's kind of spasmodic reactions in the mind. So it's like, I remember one day I was walking along and I saw a stick out of the corner of my eye and I thought it was a snake. And fear came up and I looked, and it's just a stick. But you know, this is the mind, you know, it's ready. So where's this fear coming from? Where's these stories coming from? And so what the meditation, what the practice does is it starts to slow everything down. So then we start to have sense restraint, which is like the guarding. So we guard seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching and thinking. So the mind doesn't just run off into liking and disliking anymore. So then when we get some contact, that we can just see it as contact. We don't have to add a story onto it. So the suffering that we experience is that when we see a sight, we say we don't like it, and then we start ruminating on that. We start thinking of all the reasons why we don't like it, and then suddenly we hate it, and then suddenly it's the worst thing in the world. And all it was is, you know, like an angry dog or something you saw, and you made this huge story out of it. And so what the mindfulness training does is that we learn to be mindful of, there's a teaching called the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. So it's awareness of the body. So usually that's the foundation. So whether you like actually like being inside your body, feeling your body movements, aware when you're extending your arm, aware when you're moving your leg, or like awareness of the breath. Breath is always with us. So I know people who I know one friend particularly, and he's aware of his breath all day. Whatever he's doing, he's aware of his breath. And he has breath, this constant, this foundation for mindfulness. So that's what's possible. But to get there, we have to start with where we're at. So it's like the idea of meditation is it's a more formal posture. But then we can sit down and we're like, okay, I'm going to try and be mindful for the next 15 minutes. And that's your goal to begin with. And then once you can do 15 minutes, just extend it a little bit. And once you start to get a bit of mindfulness in your meditation, then you try and start to extend it through your day. But the way the Buddha taught it was a thing called the gradual training. And so you actually start with your precepts. So lay people have the 5 precepts. Or maybe on the moon observances, the 8 precepts. And the monks have 200 and something precepts and 1,000 dukkhitas. But the idea is they're just things to keep you out of suffering. So if you go kill a living being, for example, it's going to be on your mind. Or if you lie, it's going to be on your mind. If you drink alcohol or take drugs, which aren't necessary, then they're going to mean you can't practice properly. And you don't have clear thinking. And they may even lead to addiction. And so it's like the precepts the Buddhas teach, this Buddha is the same as the last Buddhas, they're just teaching us things that stop us from suffering. So we learn this kind of basic restraint, and once we have that restraint, then we can start working on our speech. Then we can, well, one of the precepts is learn to avoid lying. But then we can purify our speech further and then even our minds. And the Buddha used, this Buddha, Buddha Siddhartha Gautama, used breath meditation as his main object. And why breath meditation is useful is it's always with us. And so when I was at work, I used to try and, throughout the day, I'd have a little mantra I would use, like Buddha, try and use Buddha at least every hour. And then when I had a quiet time, I would try and do a little bit of breath meditation. And then so by the time I did my next meditation in the evening or in the early morning or whenever it was, you know, you haven't let the kettle go cold. You kind of move, your mindfulness gets to build drip by drip. And then I think the difference is lay people. I mean, the Buddha, the reason why the Buddha has the Sangha is because being a monk or a nun, you get to dedicate your life to spiritual practice. You know, you're supported by others. It's very easy to practice because you have all the time in the day. But he said a household life is dusty and crowded. So actually, to go to the effort of practicing while you're in a householder, you know, it's a big sacrifice. So you've just got to start with where you're at, and that little bit of effort is a sacrifice. And then you see immediately it starts paying off, because instead of being quick to react, you're slow to react. So if you're an angry person, suddenly you might be able to see your anger arising and not necessarily get into that argument. Or if you're a greedy person, you might be able to close the fridge. or whatever the defilement is. Or, you know, if you're a sleepy person, you might be able to not sleep so much. Or whatever the defilement is. Because we're all different. That's why it's no point looking at other people. Because it's like as many spots as there are as a leopard, they're different people, you know. And what is challenges for us, you know, that other people might not have those challenges. So it's a very individual thing. But, you know, there's two ways. Either we're gathering towards evil or we're gathering towards good. And so if we start noticing the good actions that we're doing, the reason why, like sila is called, like moral restraint, the reason why that's useful is because then you start learning the things. It's like the science of the mind. If I do these things, then it, you know, leads to peace, leads to restraint. If I don't do these things, it leads to agitation, it leads to difficulty. I mean, if one of them is sexual misconduct. So if all the things that go wrong with sexual misconduct in the world, you know, if this one precept was kept by people, none of those things would occur. You know? And killing living beings? Well, obviously, the worst of those would be killing humans, going around killing humans. Nobody wants that. So it's not that we blindly believe them, but we just take them on board, and then we see if taking them has an effect on the mind. And if it does, then, you know, try it for a bit longer. So it's like we learn through your own experience. So then you're not just blindly grasping, you know, oh, I'm doing this because I'm a Buddhist and you know, that's what I've been told to do. But you actually learn that there is a science to the heart. And that's what the Dharma is called. Another word for the Dharma is actually law. It's actually like the law of the universe, like the natural workings of the universe. But when a Buddha teaches, what a Buddha teaches is just those things that lead towards the extinguishment of suffering. So if suffering was like a great fire in our heart, all the teachings lead towards, like if we were a really terrible worker who always did our worst every time we were at work, then like the Dharma would teach us to be more skillful, you know, to learn to be highly skilled and highly trained. And so that would be an example of an extinguishment of suffering, because we would have been both suffering for ourselves and our employer and anybody who ended up with any of our products. So it's like there's like a worldly suffering, but then the ultimate side of that is the extinguishment of the roots of suffering in the heart. And those roots are greed, hatred, and delusion. And so greed is where we go out kind of with this unrestrained passion, grasping at everything in sight. And hatred is where we go out with aversion, pushing away everything we don't like. And delusion is where we're ignorant of everything else. And so the process of enlightenment is actually waking up to our experience. So where we don't just lose hours of the day and go, oh, what was I doing? You know, I don't even know. It's like we're actually present. Like the idea of meditation is actually eventually to be present of every in-breath or every out-breath, every mouthful of food you're eating, every step that you're taking, to have total presence, total awareness. And that's why the word Buddha means awake. And before we were kind of stuck in a dream, believing all the stories of our mind. But somebody who's awake, their mind doesn't run off to the past and the future. You know, they may plan at the appropriate time, they may make decisions of what they're doing, or based on what they've done, but their mind doesn't proliferate into stories, because it sees that in itself is suffering. And so the idea of meditation, like the breath meditation, is the more we do it, if we do it regularly, then it'll actually start to slow down that thinking process. And then we'll start to be able to see it. It's just this kind of Mara, which is kind of like the great tempter. It's just got all these little puppet shows. And we're just kind of spasmodically reacting to all these puppet shows. But it's just stories in our head. It's all stories. And so when we start to put it down, then we don't have to hate people, you know? And then instead of just loving the people we like, we can have friendliness to all beings. So it's like we start to go beyond that kind of little clicky nature where we have everything as we want, but we just accept our experience as it is and try and live more fully. And so part of that is then you need like an inner dialogue. And so, you know, a lot of the reasons why people are depressed and have difficulties in life is they don't see like the value of something like the five precepts. Because once you have the precepts, you have a foundation. So you can go, well done, look, I did the precepts today. Yay, I'm a good person. And why do you need to be depressed if you've got something good in your life? And so a lot of the depression that we have is just because we've thought a certain way for a long time and we don't have an identity. So actually the first thing we do is we try and identify with goodness. Because if we identify with goodness, then we're going to gather towards goodness. And then there's two, like if we gather towards evilness, then the jug will fill drip by drip and eventually overflow. But if we gather towards goodness, then every time we do something good in our lives, every time somebody does something kind to us, we can be grateful and thankful. Every time, you know, opportunities arise, we can be grateful and thankful. So we start to take whatever the smallest things in our lives and we see that goodness. And what that does is it makes us grow towards goodness. It makes us seek out goodness and our mind inclines in that way. And then suddenly we don't have any reason to be depressed anymore, because instead of being somebody that's looking at all the faults in our life, we're somebody who's relishing in even the smallest of good things. And if everything goes wrong one day, well, you know, that's just nature. Today everything went well. Well done that you didn't break down in panic. You know, because sometimes everything's going to go wrong. But, you know, as long as we are cultivating the heart, even if we die or we lose a limb or we lose a loved one, we don't have to add extra suffering on that. You know, there will be pain and suffering that happens in life. But when we cultivate the heart, then that's something that, you know, that goes beyond lives. And in Buddhism, there's like a path to enlightenment, four stages, And for some beings, it takes them many lives to realize enlightenment. It doesn't happen in one life. But the idea is, if we start to gather towards these things and start to try and learn what wisdom is, learn from our own experience, then we can start to become wise. But if we just always want to seek out the pleasures of the senses, it's going to be very hard to meditate to begin with. But it's going to be hard when we are faced with real difficulty. Because you have to understand, if we die, then we have to let go of our loved ones, we have to let go of all of our possessions, and we have to let go of our identity with this body and move on. And so that's a difficult process if we haven't prepared for it. And that's a big part of learning to meditate, learning to be a good person, is then that doesn't matter so much. You know, when the way the Buddha taught people is, when you die, you just let go and move on. You know, whatever we do every day, that's our preparation for death. So when we die, don't look back, just move on. Even people with families, that's how he would teach, you know. So I mean, that takes a bit of practice to get to that point, and regular practice. And that's obviously the highest, because that means that then you would follow your highest karma and get the best rebirth. But if we, when we die, then we're let go and we're clinging on to this and clinging on to that, then it's going to be hard for us to move on. Because, you know, most people want to hang around to see their own funeral and which is all good. But the idea is that, and then beyond that, there's even a path to enlightenment. And what nirvana is, or nirvana, they say in the West, the Sanskrit version, that's like the extinguishment of suffering. So the highest is actually the realization of enlightenment. But, you know, there's a reason why there's not that many monks and nuns in the world, is that the basis to be a monk or nun is renunciation. And, you know, most people, we like our sense pleasures, you know, like the taste of food, like looking at a nice flower, and all these kind of simple pleasures. And so monks and nuns, we're people where we're expected to renounce a lot of this thing. But the benefit of that for us is that then, especially like we renounce money and we renounce like sexuality and things like that. Like even in the mind, when, you know, if somebody came and offers us all the diamonds and money in the world, we wouldn't be interested in it, because we're trying to cultivate our hearts. And so it's that idea that, you know, external things are impermanent, but we can build the causes in our hearts so our hearts become bright. And the brighter our hearts become, the easier for it is to understand the truth. So it's like, if we start to contemplate death and suffering and fear and pain and grief and all these things, our mind's just going to be like a feather that shrivels. But if we give our mind power through stillness, through dedicated contemplation, through quiet, peace, then when we contemplate these things, they actually lead to peace rather than suffering, because we have a foundation for the mind to actually to see with wisdom. And so that's why really the Buddha would first teach people to be generous, because when you learn to be generous, when you learn to give, so I mean, you go to the Asian countries, and you know, the monks and nuns go on Pindabad, and people are out there early in the morning giving the food, going to the monasteries, giving. And then you know, look at Burma, how it was 100 years ago. There wasn't such thing as an orphan. You know, if somebody lost their parents, somebody in the town would just take the child and be their mother. You know, so like the true way of a Buddhist is just freely giving, doing what we can. And that means we're going against that selfish inner desire and always seeing, you know, how we can help others, how we can give our best to people, give our best to ourselves. And then if you have that generosity as the base, generosity is very close to thankfulness and gratefulness. And anybody who's a truly thankful and grateful person is a great person, because they're always looking at the blessings in their life. and never looking at the difficulties. And so the generosity is training us to be a great person, and then it's easier for us to do the precepts because we already have some brightness in our heart. And I think why people overstep the precepts is because they haven't brightened their heart enough yet to see the power of them. And then it's just a process of following up them when we do break them, or we do, or we are learning about them. It's like an intelligence where we learn through our mistakes. And I've gone to great lengths to save some insects at times. You know, usually, obviously, if you accidentally kill them and you're walking or whatever, but sometimes because I've done something rash, and then I've almost killed an insect, and then I spend the next like 10 minutes trying to save its life or something. So it's like, you know, just think, no, if we don't want to die, why do other beings want to die? You know? But we're just speaking about our own immediate experience. So it's not that we have to go around and save every being in the world. But just in our own experience, we try not to kill. Because actually, look at that mind when you're killing something. Is it a mind of love or a mind of hate? I don't want you to die. It doesn't sound like a mind of love to me. So it's also a way of brightening the mind, because then we don't have aversion in the mind. And you get a mosquito bite or a fly landing on you. Is it really the end of the world? Do we really have to kill every insect or mouse or something? I had this thing when I was a layperson, because there was a few cockroaches, not many in my house. So eventually I came up with the thing that when I opened a cupboard, I would close my eyes for the first 2 seconds. And only if I ever saw a cockroach, then I would set about trying to catch them. And that pretty much solved the problem. So there must have only been a few in my house. Because the reason we possess things, you know, we say it's my house. But is it our house, or is it the mice's house? Or is it the cockroach's house? Or is it the ant's house? Who says it's our house? A piece of paper? How long does that piece of paper last? And so Ajahn Chah used to say that about the, you know, they'll have geckos living in their little wahara. And so that's like this, that's where this suffering comes from, that we identify with things. You know, my family, my house, my body has to be like this, otherwise I won't be happy. But the deeper Buddhist teachings, I notice a lot of Western people, they want to jump right into the deeper teachings. But first, we really need the generosity and the sila, because they're the things that brighten the heart. If we don't have a bright heart, it's very hard to be somebody who's willing to do a bit of renunciation. So when we do the meditation, that's where we're developing the sense restraint and the renunciation and learning to be silent and still and calm. And if we don't have a bright heart, we're going to feel agitated and uncomfortable. And so I think that's why the Buddha said to lay people, dana, sila, bhavana, learning to give, learning moral precepts, and then cultivation of mind is the third part. So this kind of overt focus on meditation, I think, can be misplaced. It's better to look at it from, you know, when we open our eyes in the morning to when we go to bed at night. That's our practice. And also we can just, like Ajahn Chah, some people are wisdom people. So the more we practice, then we just contemplate when some suffering arises or some problem arises. Like, what's the problem? If we do die, like sometimes I'm somebody, we're meant to have few possessions as monks, but I do a bit of note-taking, and sometimes my notes get a bit out of control. So every now and then I have this meditation and all of my notes burning. Then I lose everything. It's okay. Now, if I lose everything, that I have. I'll probably get some more stuff. I think even if we lost our robes, we're allowed to go make a grass robe, you know, until somebody comes and gives us another one. So, you know, we could lose everything. There was actually this monk at the time of the Buddha. He kept coming across homeless people, and he would give him his robes and come back to the monastery naked. So eventually the Buddha said, okay, you can make grass robes. But the point being is that we don't have to attach to our stuff too tightly. You know, we look after our possessions, we look after the possessions of others, but we should contemplate that these things aren't permanent. You know, we take them for a while, but one day they're going to break apart. And then that makes us prepared for when we do break the things that we like, or people that we know do pass away. Then we can wish them well, or we can be grateful for using that possession for while we had it, rather than our mind falling into suffering and sadness. Anyway, it's a pretty long talk tonight, so I will now do a guided meditation. Okay. Start by getting yourself in a comfortable position. Usually kind of upright, alert is good, particularly if you're somebody who tends to get tired in meditation, very upright posture. And if you're a bit agitated, then try and relax a bit more. So you just look at how the mind is, how the body is. Use a bit of wisdom. Start by coming into the present moment. You put down external things, whatever's happening out there, just let go of everything. Don't need to think of the past or the future or worry about anything at all. Even everybody in this room, just let everybody go. It's the time to be peaceful and quiet and content. Whatever happens in meditation is good enough. A useful technique is to start by relaxing the body. Start by relaxing the toes and feet. Just bring the mind down to that area. Just by noticing the feelings in the toes and feet, you can start to relax them. Bring this kind awareness, relaxation to the toes and feet. Into the ankles from inside out, the lower legs, and the center to the surface, moving up the lower legs, all the way up the calves and the shins, up towards the knees, relaxing the knees from inside out, moving into the thighs, the lower thigh, middle of the thighs, the upper thighs. Completely relax. Weight of the body onto the seat or the cushion. Everything in the area of the waist, the belly. Just become aware of the belly as it rises and falls. Some people actually watch the breath of the belly, but it's very grounding. In breath ride, the belly rises. Out breath, belly falls. Tuning into the rising and falling of the belly. Grounding us in the present moment. Aware of the belly from inside out, rising with an in-breath, falling with an out-breath. No need to be in a hurry. Just slowing down. Relax the lower back and sides, middle back and sides, spreading into the upper back, shoulder blades, everything in the upper back, all the muscles unwinding, opening up, relaxing. Tops of the shoulders, back down to the belly, the diaphragm and the solar plexus, relaxing deeply. The upper torso, the chest, the heart, letting go of any difficulties, and the lungs. Just become aware of the lungs as they fill up with an in-breath, an empty out-breath. Actually, there's this wind that fills up the lungs and empties from the lungs. This is the in-breath and the out-breath. So lungs fill up and empty, tuning into the breath, tuning into peace. Anytime you find the mind agitated or disturbed in the meditation, just take a few deep breaths, recenter yourself, and start again. No right or wrong in meditation. It's just about learning to do the work, doing our best. That's good enough. Aware of the in-breath filling up the lungs. Aware of the out-breath exiting from the lungs. Presence of mind, right here with this simple task. And try and have a welcoming attitude, like we're welcoming a dear friend, welcoming the in-breath, welcoming the out-breath, welcoming the letting go. Not being in a hurry. Relax from the shoulders to the neck. The neck holds up our head all day. Just relax all the muscles of the neck, everything inside the neck, permeated with relaxation, suffused with this kind awareness. Relax the chin, the lower jaw, gums, the teeth, the tongue, the upper jaw, the upper teeth, upper gums, the lips, the cheeks, totally relax, under the nostrils, the ridge of the nose, the side of the nose, out into the upper cheeks, the ears, the back of the head, top of the head, temples, around the eyes, the eyelids, the eyelashes, the eyes themselves. So much tension held in the eyes, all the worries, anxieties, agitation can be felt in the eyes. To really relax the eyes. Let the eyes become peaceful, unagitated, relaxed. These kind eyes, smiling eyes. Eyes of wisdom, eyes of peace. Relax the eyebrows and the forehead. Any lingering stress, wherever it's coming from, let it go. Let the forehead relax completely, smooth and relaxed. Not a single tension remaining. And the whole head, the neck, shoulders, arms and hands, the back, front of the torso, the whole of the torso, the waist, the legs, the feet. Entire physical body. This brought, bringing this kind awareness. Any lingering feelings, we just accept them with kindness. Allow the body to look after itself. Letting go of any aversion. Any feelings remaining, just having friendliness. We allow the body to look after itself for the rest of the meditation. Bring the attention to the mind, spiritual mind, the heart, whatever you want to call it, a place of experience. Accept the mind as it is, like a dear friend, a long lost friend. You may not visit it very often. Now, you see this friend again, you welcome it with open heart. Any difficulties, you can let go of and forgive. Just be right here now in the present moment. With an in-breath, you breathe in peace, an out-breath, let go, peace, let go. Just find how to watch the breath, it's most natural. Some people at the lip, some at the nostril, some at the belly, some at the heart. Just choose one that seems natural to you for the rest of the meditation. Breathe in peace. Now let go. not being demanding, friendly to whatever is arising in our experience. Breathe in peace. Breathe out, let go. Being awake to one in-breath, awake to one out-breath. Breathe in peace. Breathe out, let go. Sensing this peace is luminous and open, not asking anything. Quietness, peace, stillness. Breathe in peace. Breathe out, let go. Attitude of friendliness and openness. Breathe in peace. Breathe out, let go. Aware of the whole of an in-breath. Aware of the whole of an out-breath. Like this interest to be with the breath. What's the texture and temperature of the in-breath? What's the texture and temperature of the out-breath? Are we really with the in-breath? Are we really with the out-breath? Breathe in peace. This feeling of relaxation, friendliness, soft clouds, very subtle. Instilling any lingering agitation in the mind. gladdening the mind I breathe in, gladdening the mind I breathe out. Stilling the mind I breathe in. Stilling the mind I breathe out. It's unshakable peace, unshakable stillness. Whatever level is good enough. Unshakable peace I breathe in. Unshakable peace I breathe out. Sense of enjoyment and ease. Unshakable peace I breathe in. Unshakable peace I breathe out. I'll be silent for the next 5 or 7 minutes. unshakable peace I breathe in, unshakable peace I breathe out. Liberating the mind, I breathe in. Liberating the mind, I breathe out. Whatever shackles, difficulties, problems there may they be untied and let go of them. Liberating the mind, I breathe in. Liberating the mind, I breathe out. Spiritual mind, the heart, whatever you want to call it. Freeing the mind, I breathe in. Freeing the mind, I breathe out. Mind, I breathe in. Freeing the mind, I breathe out. Sadhu, sadhu. May I continue being joyful. Whatever good actions are in my life, may I notice them, make much of them, enjoy the results. Sadhu, sadhu. May I continue being joyful. Hare, mudita, with appreciative joy. May I share this joy with those in this room. May we all here continue being joyful. Those in Perth, in Western Australia, in Australia, animals, the devas, the humans, whatever beings there may be, may they continue being joyful. In the world, the universe, the ambrosial, whatever beings there may all beings continue being joyful. Heart of equanimity and joy. May all beings be at ease. Brings an end to the meditation. May you take this peace and joy with you into your lives. Now let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration.
Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all precious leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life, may they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nirvana. In every kind of birth, may I have an upright mind, with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge, unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble Lord, the Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.
A little blessing.
Rakantu sabba devata sabba buddha nupavena sada suti pavantu te pavatu sabba mangalam rakantu sabba devata sabba dhamma nupavena sada suti pavantu te pavatu sabba mangalam rakantu sabba devata sabba sangha nupavena sada suti pavantu te.
Very good. Thank you all for coming.